This episode of GameScoop is sponsored by Squarespace. If you're looking for a way to make your business stand out and succeed online, Squarespace is the all-in-one website platform for you. They take the stress out of creating an awesome website, engaging with your audience, and selling anything from products to content to time, so you're able to focus on, you know, everything else. In other words, you'll have more time for gaming. With the new guided design system, you can choose from curated layouts and styling options to build a unique online presence from the ground up, optimized for every device. And with Squarespace's integrated, optimized SEO tools, you'll show up more often to more people. Squarespace doesn't just make things easier for you. Checkout for your customers is made seamless with simple but powerful payment tools that allow you to accept credit cards, PayPal, and Apple Pay, and in eligible countries, offer the option to buy now and pay later with Afterpay and Clearpay. So whether you're just starting out or looking to expand your existing brand, be sure to visit squarespace.com for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/gamescoop to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. That's squarespace.com/gamescoop for 10% off. You know, when it comes to wireless carriers, sometimes what you see isn't always what you get. Except with Visible. With Visible, what you see is exactly what you get. If you haven't heard of Visible, well, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. With Visible, there are no hidden fees, no fine print, no hassle, nothing to hide. It's just $25 a month, all taxes and fees included. And you don't need more than one line of wireless to save. You can save on a line all to yourself with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon. And again, just $25 a month. The future of wireless is here, and it is transparent. If you want more transparency in your wireless plan, you want to be on the Visible plan. Switch to Visible today and save at Visible.com. That's Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com. What's up, everybody? Welcome to IGN GameScoop. I'm your host, Damon Hatfield. Joining me this week are Sam Claiborne.
Hey, Damon.
And Nick Lamone.
Hey, how's it going?
And we have a show for you this week. Will it be great? I don't know. It's the second episode we're recording this week. We recorded a regular episode earlier in the week with myself and Sam and Justin and Colin Stevens. Due to some unfortunate technical issues, the audio in the episode is not good. There are lots of pops and clicks all throughout the episode. It would not be a pleasant experience for your ears to have to sit through
Damon,
that.
I propose that we call this episode Game Scroop, because we done screwed up.
Game Scroop. That's pretty good.
First time for me, though.
What could we have done?
First time for Game Scroop?
No. This is the first time I'm experiencing this.
This is just Game Scroop for Nick, but for us, it's normal.
Sure. So what were we to do? We could have just, you know, skipped this week, left Scoop Nation with nothing to listen to, considering this is the only video game podcast in existence. But no, it's Friday afternoon. Usually the episode has been up for hours now, but it's Friday afternoon now. We're sitting down. We're going to record a makeup episode for you. And I can hear all of Scoop Nation saying, but Damon, how did you have the time to write a whole new show and do all the research for all the news stories? Well, that's where I'm going to lean on you, Scoop Nation, and your emails. Your emails are going to make up the bulk of this show. And actually, I turned the clock back. I have a GameScoop inbox with over 3,000 emails that haven't been read on the show yet. And I sorted them by oldest.
You read each one. That's the important thing.
Yeah, I read each one. And then I tuck them away if I want to use them at some point. Mm-hmm. So the oldest ones are from November of 2019 in my inbox right now. So that's where we're reaching back. And I think it will be amusing for all involved. But first, God of War Ragnarok is, of course, out this week. We've been talking a lot about this. We talked about it last week and shared a bunch of non-spoilery opinions. On the last episode from this week, we got Colin Stevens' opinions on God of War. He loves it. He had nothing but glowing praise for it. Now it is time to get Nick Lamone's opinion of God of War Ragnarok, which is...
And by the way, Nick just beat the dang game.
Yeah, I finished it very, very late last night, as you can probably tell by the eye bags under my eyes. I stayed up very late like a delinquent and then powered through the game. And at just about a little over 30 hours, I rolled credits and I had a great time. That said, you know, I think it's basically impossible to address the overall quality of this game without comparing it to the 2018 release. And I think between the two, there's still something about the 2018 release that hits me a little bit harder than Ragnarok did. Don't get me wrong. I adore God of War Ragnarok, but I think the highs of 2018 kind of outweigh the highs of Ragnarok. And I think a lot of that is due to the fact that there was quite a bit of a gap between God of War Ascension and then God of War 2018. And God of War 2018 was such a breath of fresh air for the franchise. It was a fundamental shift from gameplay, perspective, and just overall tone and theme for God of War. So a lot of iconic moments from 2018 that stand out to me are just Kratos fighting the dragon, and you beat the dragon, and at the end of the battle, the mouth is like open and it falls with Kratos just standing in the center, and it just feels like epic in a way that I don't know that anything quite does in Ragnarok. Mm-hmm. But that said, opening of Ragnarok left me awestruck. There's the first encounter of the game. You know, 2018 had the encounter with Baldur. Mm-hmm. The encounter that you have at the beginning of this game is just something truly special that I love. It's a thing that only video games can do, and the thing that they do is just so good. I don't want to spoil it, but it is fantastic.
Yeah, very good video game. And I was saying on the last episode that there's a point, one criticism I had is that there's a point 10 or 12 hours into it, Nick, we'll see if you agree, where the game sort of takes a hard left turn, and I thought all the wind went out of the sails, all the momentum was dragged down, and it was just kind of a long, meandering, boring section. Nick, do you know the point I'm talking about, and do you agree, disagree?
Yes. I 100% agree. It is once I got about to that point of the game, that was the first time I considered, was like, oh, you know what? Maybe I should take a break today. Like, maybe I'm done playing for the day. And I think, you know, that I think that that kind of side of the game ends up turning into something a lot more interesting later on. But that first zag definitely drags a little bit. Yeah. And I think the game does suffer a little bit from some pacing issues overall. It is much longer than God of War 2018. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But that said, there's plenty of game in store here.
Yeah. And also I'm happy to report I'm still playing it. I'm in like 21 or 22 hours now. And ever since that segment I just mentioned, I think the game just keeps getting better and better. There hasn't been any other stumbles like that. I'm really, really enjoying it. And I'm taking my time with it, not trying to rush to the end. Although from what Nick was saying, it sounds like I have about 10 hours left, maybe something like that.
I mean, Nick just gave me like really crazy news. I was like, here's where I am. And I kind of described it. He's like, Oh yeah, you're not quite at the 50% mark yet, which I can't believe, because I'm, you know, when I look at my game count, my hours count, it's probably 17 or 18 hours.
Yeah,
my numbers are a little bit skewed because I'm a completionist, so I tend to, when I get a side quest or like a collect,
man. guides guy.
very fair. So actually, maybe you are further along than I anticipated.
No, I think I'm just taking longer, and that's fine. I mean, for me, like I really should talk about this game for my own mental health online anymore. But for the people that agreed with me ahead of not playing this game, and the people that disagreed with me ahead of not playing this game, I hope you all get to play it and then get back to us about your thoughts on it, because I'm really curious about what you think. However, Colin had brought up a point about how, you know, there's parts of it that seemed a little bit stretched. And then we talked about on this you know, last episode, a little bit about how the ending is supposedly has a really good run, like a 5 or 6 hour, like amazing run. Beginning's pretty cool. So there's just some doldrums in the middle. And that's, you know, that just happens in games. And for some people, though, I would like to point out that's just all of that just sounds good. People are like, I don't know what you're talking about. I want more game. And I can choose whether I wanted to stretch it out or not by playing side quests or not. And that's up to me. So, you know, more power to those people. And, you know, like right now, I know the pattern of the game and I like it when it breaks the pattern, but I'm in my third, maybe fourth kind of area that a dog-like creature pulls you around on sleds and you kill groups of enemies, you do little side quests, and then you just, or you can just go to the boss. Like that's like, that keeps happening. It's like worlds in Super Mario World, the kind of modern version. It's kind of interesting, but, yeah, you know, that's just, that's what this game is.
I think. I think it's directly at odds with the kind of story this game's trying to tell. Like, I think it's a very similar criticism I have of a game like The Last of Us Part 2, where you want to make sure that there's plenty of game for a player to enjoy. But I think that the story it's telling is directly at odds with long, drawn-out gameplay sequences because they feel good versus what the story demands of that particular moment. So it feels like they're a little bit at odds with each other, story versus gameplay, where ideally, I think they'd be closer to a Last of Us 1 where it's a short and sweet experience. It's 10 hours, you're in, you're out, and you're good to go. But you know what? That said, I do love beating up fools as Kratos. So it all works
That's
out.
That's funny. That's like an aspect of like any games that have, you know, exploration elements or larger areas. If you're going to do like a heart palpitating story, every time you're taking a second, they kind of like, and they try to explain that away with, oh, my dad likes loot, like stuff like that. It just comes across as like totally silly, where it's like, if we don't get here, the end of the world is going to happen. And if we don't do this and this and this first, then, you know, and then it's just like, you stop and you're like, now where's that third torch I can light to get a Minotaur horn?
I do love the commentary of basically Kratos being a kleptomaniac throughout. They're like, my dad loves loot. Yeah. You don't understand, guys. He needs the loot.
Yeah, they make fun of other very characters silly. You play as too. And they talk about, you know, oh, you have to pick up everything not nailed down.
Yeah,
it's really funny. Yeah. But it also like that's like fourth wall breaking stuff where a game like tries to take itself really seriously in a lot of cases. But then, you know, there's a lot of fun to be had. It's an interesting balance to strike. Like there's like the big class of Easter eggs in this game have to do with poems you find. And it's completely like, you know, at odds with like the kind of the serious nature of what's happening. And I think that's what makes video games fun. And I think that that's a great thing, but also it makes me also just like really skeptical of the games as storytelling devices in general, because I just rather have the fun.
And real quick on those poems, last one, because they're all spoilers. Maybe it's like an Easter egg thing.
Take 30 seconds if you don't want to know this, although it's all over the place now. And it's from the beginning of the game.
I'm going to hold for just a second, but the Kvasir's poems are all centered around PlayStation exclusive titles. And I think I'm going to plant the flag right now, the sad flag. I think this might be the last time Sony ever acknowledges the Order 1886.
Oh, wow.
Ever. They actually acknowledge it, and I was like, oh my god, they did it. Wow. Also, underrated game. Love Order 1886.
Yeah,
all right,
love
sorry,
it.
I'm done.
Wow.
Well, some of the names are just, they just swap out, you know, the names of these games with synonyms for all the words in them. And the best one is called, like, it's like Large Society Ground Orb, the event. And that's Major Wait. League Baseball, the show.
Oh my god! I was trying to figure it out.
Oh, sorry. That'd be a fun game for GameScoop next week.
Is there one for Ghost of Tsushima?
There is. I don't know what it is.
I don't know.
Top of my
I just
head,
wrote the Easter eggs page. And
oh,
if
is
that's
there not?
The case, then I called. I made a wrong call on one of them.
No, I'm probably mistaken then. But I think the funniest one that made me chuckle the loudest was the one that they had for Uncharted. That is very long.
Yeah. It's like upon losing yourself in an you know an unknown territory or something.
Something silly. Well, that brings us to our first email from November 2019.
Nice.
It came from James Carter in the UK in Cheshire, UK. James said, "Hey guys, this is what 3 years ago. Hey guys, love the show. Listen regularly on my commute to work. I've recently completed all of God of War and Spider-Man on my PS4 Pro after finally getting around to them. During these games, I found the combat really fluent and enjoyable, but often found that there were too many moves and combos to try and perform involving too many buttons, which led me to ignore them almost entirely. My question to you guys is whether in a game like God of War, you stick to a simple combat system or try and utilize all the combo moves you've been shown." And this relates to some commentary that Sam had been making about the game. Yeah. That I don't know. Nick, what do you think? Sam, and I might agree with him, just thinks maybe there's just too many different combos. It's starting to get into like Street Fighter territory.
I think the game makes it very easy to find the old reliable when it comes to what the combo is that works. Totally. But that said, I think the game allows for improvisation if you desire that extra layer of complexity. I think the biggest difference between a game like God of War or Spider-Man versus, say, Devil May Cry Devil May Cry demands that you utilize every single combo and tool at your disposal in order to succeed, whereas God of War and Spider-Man, not necessarily the case. They're just there for those people who want a little bit more. I think for the most part, most players in God of War tend to focus on just, hey, I am using a weapon and I will use all the combos for this weapon. And during this combat, just using this weapon. But I think the more advanced players mix and match in between combos of swapping weapons on the fly and utilizing all the different runic abilities and whatnot. So,
and then really advanced players just poison the enemies and they die much faster.
Yeah, and then they run away the entire time and run in circles. I think game allows for it, but it is, yeah, a little bit much at times.
So let me qualify that criticism, because I saw that portrayed unfairly. I don't give a crap about button combos. Put all the button combos in you want. Nick pointed out that's for some people. Do that. But since the game doesn't make you use them, I have no use to spend my skill points. That's
what I was going to say.
So if there was a skill tree option for the way I like to play, which is, say, vaulting enemies in the air or kicking them off cliffs, or, I do actually like the poison in the game. Like, there's no way for me to kind of, you know, keep on going those directions. I can just buy stuff that I'm never going to use. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I feel the same way. Like, anytime a game with a skill tree has skills that you can buy that, like, add extra combos to your combat, I just end up ignoring those, because that's just not like it's completely different from, like, so unlocking extra health for me. Okay, that's just going to be that's just a passive benefit for me. I don't have to do anything else. Mm-hmm. I feel like unlocking new combos is like more work for me. It's just it's just another thing that I have to think about. You know,
one of the great mid game combat things I'm arriving at now is that I die in encounters or just have no problem with them. And the same encounter, like, I just won't be paying attention for a second, and I'll be like, "Whoa, I just died! I can't believe I died!" And then I'll go back there, like, "Why did I die in that? These are just like kind of like mid enemies." And then I'll be fine, because it takes that much concentration to fight in this game. It is not mindless. And that is a great thing. I just came off of Gotham Knights. That's totally mindless. Like, they took out all the elements of you possibly being defeated by the enemies in that game. But Batman Arkham Asylum or Arkham City, it was not like that. You had to pay attention. Or Shadow of Mordor is a really good example of that, too. They start adding combos, but the combos are funny in those games. They're like, it's like after you get around to all the buttons, they don't make you do like L1, 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 R1, L1, they make you do like press X and A together or Y and B together. And I always thought that was like a really fun innovation that like helped me remember I had more moves, but didn't make me think about like the you know, Shoryuken type moves.
Cool. Well, that's God of War Ragnarok. It's out now. Scoop Nation is, I'm sure, enjoying it. I'll be looking on in the Facebook group to see what
everyone's thinking. Yeah, first weekend. I hope everybody enjoys it this weekend. Yeah.
This episode of GameScoop is brought to you by NordVPN. As Scoop Nation knows, your Omega Cops have been a little obsessed with a movie called Weekend at Bernie's lately. But as happens too often these days, it is difficult to find it streaming here in the US. That's where NordVPN comes in. With NordVPN, you can switch your virtual location to a more enlightened region where they appreciate the comic delights of Weekend at Bernie's. And it's not just for streaming movies and shows. Switching your virtual location can allow you to save money by purchasing flights, hotels, and subscriptions from other countries at a cheaper price. And you can do all this worry-free, as NordVPN threat protection features protect you from viruses, malware, and phishing sites. Best of all, NordVPN costs the price of a cup of coffee a month, and one account can be used on up to 6 devices. To get the best discount on your NordVPN plan, go to nordvpn.com/gamescoop. Our link will also give you 4 extra months on the 2-year plan. There's no risk with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. That's nordvpn.com/gamescoop. 1 in 5 Americans has learned a new language on their bucket list, or life backlog, if you will. If that's you, make 2024 the year you finally check it off the list with Babbel. Upgrade your personal skill set in 2024 with Babbel, the science-backed language learning app that actually works. Babbel's quick 10-minute lessons are handcrafted by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. Its tips and tools are approachable, accessible, rooted in real-life situations, and deliver with conversation-based teaching so you're ready to practice what you've learned in the real world. I have a trip to Mexico coming up, so I've been using Babbel to brush up on my Spanish. The courses are short and sweet, so I can do one whenever I have a few minutes to spare. And the words and phrases it teaches you are designed for practical, real-world use, like ordering at a restaurant or asking for directions. Babbel can even provide you feedback on your pronunciation with its speech recognition tech. And it's not just for Spanish. Babbel includes 14 different language courses, each backed by a 20-day money-back guarantee. Here's a special limited time deal for Scoop Nation. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription only for our listeners at babbel.com/gamescoop. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/gamescoop, spelled BABBEL.com/gamescoop. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Yeah, yeah. It's a great game. I love it. Have both of you seen Black Panther?
I have.
I have
Nick,
not.
You haven't. So Nick is, or I'm sorry, Sam is the only one who's seen it. Sam, what did you think?
If you guys want to talk about it, totally fine.
I haven't seen it. I haven't seen it.
I like it. I just wanted to know what Sam thought. This movie is so similar to Doctor Strange and the Multiverse of Madness and then Thor 4 in the sense that like these movies are not like the other Marvel movies except for maybe the Infinity Wars. They're completely bloated. And they have so much going on and some, like multiple factions and giant battles. And it's like, you know, I'm here for it. There's just always an element of them, which is like, eh, this part isn't as well thought out because they're not tight. Right. So it's like this one has this giant, you know, Namor civilization part of it. And like, it, like Wakanda is like when somebody tells you at face value, oh, there's been this hidden nation forever and like nobody's ever heard of it. And like at face value, you're like, that seems impossible, but they explain it really well. And I love how it's handled in Black Panther and the Infinity War. The hidden water civilization is like, it becomes a stretch. It's like, there's another one of these. And like for like people like taking that in, they're like, there's another one. You know, it's just kind of like silly. But but like they handle it as well as they could. It's like a bunch of mer people, you know, like it's like this stuff shouldn't work. And like Marvel movies make this stuff work pretty dang well. So that's really fun. I saw it in 4DX. Have you heard of this? So this is a Star Tours outfitted theater. Basically, the seats don't just jiggle or vibrate. They go up and down, like maybe a foot or more of motion. You can get thrown. Like it is crazy uncomfortable while it's doing like a punchy kicky scene. And it's like throwing you around like you're the characters. It's not even for like, you know, spaceship crashes and stuff. So that's kind of funny. And they spray mist in, which of course this is a very water heavy movie, and they do flashes and smoke, which there's no warning for, right? They don't tell you, hey, by the way, the smoke that's going to happen in this movie is not the theater catching on fire. And when you're on like the fourth floor in a skyscraper in San Francisco, you're like, I don't know if this is the most comfortable movie experience, but it was wild. And like, I don't know what movie people want to see like that, but that exists out there. So you know, just be ready. If you go in, like maybe don't buy the drinks at the concession stand that are in glass bottles because you'll chip your tooth. Maybe don't bring any liquids in at all because the seats are stained already and you can tell why. It's crazy. Yeah. It's crazy. So that was funny. But like it didn't hurt or you know, ruin the movie for me. But it did interrupt the kind of, you know, when you start sinking in your seat and you get really locked into your movie. That's my favorite thing about movies. And so this was just a different experience.
I have a couple questions about Black Panther. We'll see if you can answer without any spoilers. I liked most of the original Black Panther, but I was disappointed that the end, like the final act, does what so many Marvel movies do, and it's just like CGI vomit. And there's like a big fight between Black Panther and Killmonger that where they're just CGI like cartoon characters. Mm. Whereas I love the Russo brothers era of the MCU, where the action scenes are all really good, really well choreographed. So much of it is happening in camera, and there wasn't an over reliance on CGI. So first of all, Is there an over-reliance on CGI fights?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think it has a mix. I think it has some good, like, kind of fist-to-fist stuff. But one of the CG sequences is actually really cool. It's like what you've never seen before. It's like a kind of a city destruction disaster thing that's, like, really fun to watch. That was good. But there's sea battles, right? And those take place, like, on, you know, above the water and below the water. And, like, nope, nobody's good at that. Not even James Cameron. I've seen those trailers. Like that stuff just like it doesn't look
they
like,
actually go like, in the water, Sam, in yeah. Way of the Water. Yeah,
yeah. So did they in this. And that was a trailer ahead of this and also Little Mermaid. And I was like, what is happening? What is like everybody Water's in this back, theater baby. Is gonna get sprayed for the next couple years based on the release schedule of these movies. But yeah, there's some overly CG stuff. And there's you know, like the Marvel world that we live in now also has like tons of like Iron Man technology in it. Remember that from the previous Spider-Man's? Mm-hmm. there's a lot of that too. And like Iron Man was always cool because it was like, you know, this jetting around thing, but like there's a lot of iron things now. And like that's a thing where it starts to add up and become a little bit CG heavy too. So just be ready for that. Not to mention, by the way, like the Multiverse of Madness and then the Ant-Man movie coming out. Those movies are like, there's not a single scene set on Earth probably after the first 5 minutes. So it's like all CG,
yeah.
Which is like, that can be cool and like psychedelic and neat, or it can just be like a little bit wearying. It's, you know, it's not like Andor. Watch Andor if you want to see like full CG all the time. Like they filmed that on like Unreal Engine sets. And it's the best looking thing I've ever seen. It's just incredible. Every single scene is, you know, an amalgamation of like 70s style from Star Wars and like crazy Blade Runner backgrounds and, you know, amazing stuff. Like watch that show if you want to see how this stuff could look. It's amazing.
It took me a few episodes, but now I'm fully on board with Andor.
Holy crap, man. The last three episodes, I just cannot believe it. It is the Star Wars thing to check out.
Okay, and then also, Sam, you're reviewing a game now, I think.
You
at least share what you're going to review?
Yeah, so I'm working on Atari 50, which is the Atari collection. I'm playing it on multiple platforms, but here it is on the Switch. And what's just completely amazing is that it has just the biggest like bunch of background information, you know, stuff that you expect from a Digital Eclipse collection, but also documentaries and stuff like that. And what's cool is that it's not just Atari the console, because that is not as interesting for a lot of people. It's Atari Arcade, the console, the dawn of their PC era, they call it. They have a ton of like cool PC Atari games, and then 1990s, which is like Jaguar and Lynx. Many games, over 100 games. And then they have rethought out games that the Digital Eclipse team, by the way, I know a lot of them. They're really interesting developers with interesting backgrounds, right? They bring a lot to Digital Eclipse, and they've got in there and just wanted to make games in addition to making this collection, right? So they have a bunch going on of like kind of remastered stuff and remade and completely new, really reimagined stuff. But as you go through, it's like the whole thing's built like this intricate mapped timeline, and you're going through it, and you might see a business card or a quote. But the next thing might be a 10-minute interview with somebody really significant, Nolan Bushnell, who, you know, invented, wow, you know, who founded Atari, or, you know, or it'll be like Tim Schafer and people like talking about their experience with a game they grew up playing. Like it's like absolutely incredible. And the package looks so cool and Atari like, and I've just scratched the surface of this. I'm just going to like, you know, curl up and play this all weekend. I'm so excited. And let me just say, like, Atari is one of the few companies you can get away with this doing, because, like, you know, they got all these games for all these generations. The licensing is interesting, and they can get that all. They can't get, you know, Star Wars games or anything like that, right? So that's missing. But I was remarking to Nick before this, Digital Eclipse, top of their game for collections. They do everything right. They did the TMNT collection earlier this year, but Nintendo. Like, think about Nintendo actually doing this.
I know.
We would never get that type of archiving. They did it. They did a really cool archive booklet with Super Mario All-Stars on Wii. And then they also did Iwata Asks, this internet series, 10 years ago now, that was actually compiled into a book, which is really good. But that was missing the media, which is a bunch of scans and stuff from their archives. Digital Eclipse, like, when they got, like, this is, like, the quintessential thing for them to get. Like, the Atari archives, it spans generations, and there's a lot of like fun games you might not know about that they can show you in this. I'm already looking at games that I've heard about my entire life, like Miner 2049er. And like, I just went in there and played that, and it's like a totally like completely silly but fun Donkey Kong knockoff that I've always wanted to play. And it's like, it looks present, everything immediately is presented with like, you know, what this should look like on a television. It looks great. Mm-hmm. It just looks so cool. They got the bezel for Pong. They went out and took pictures, got that, put it in there. I have a Pong machine in my house. It's about, you know, 20 feet away from me. And I played, you know, I know that game inside and out. I work on it. This sounds more like Pong than anything I've ever heard. They got the sound right, the look right. And it's just like unbelievable, the love that went into this. So look out for more on that.
Question I have regarding the Atari thing is just from someone who, like NES and Super Nintendo were my first consoles, and I have gone back since to try and play a lot of Atari games, and they didn't quite grab me the way, you know, like an NES remake would, or an NES collection. Is there something that, like, you think could hook people who have never, like, never touched an Atari before, or even an Atari like title, like something older? Is there an NES remix style thing where it just, here's a grab bag of all the games, you have 15 seconds to play this part of them or something?
The closest thing is that they've taken some of the classic games and just kind of redone them in a very clever way, so you can like play these standalones or like that. But let me say, Atari might not ever be for everybody because it's primitive, and it was way behind the arcades at the time and PCs. This collection has arcade games and PC games in it that are much more interesting for a lot of people probably than the Atari classics. So they're the 2600 games. So explore the 2600 games, and then you're only scratching the surface of what's in this collection. You know, Jaguar alone is like such a weird, wild, cool system to dip in. I mean, we're seeing some of the games right now. And then the end of the Atari era, like iRobot, which is super cool and fun. Like stuff like that, like check those out. And the vector games that are, you know, done to the best of the ability, you know, that you can emulate them. You know, stuff like that is in there. So not exactly like Remix, but I think the an equivalent amount of like, kind of ways to pick your interest if you are trying to explore this stuff.
Nice.
Can't wait to check it out. We'll see if I can step away from God of War for
I know. It's a tough time of year, but you know what? We have a whole year until Atari's 51.
And now we are joined by a very special guest, Warren Davis, designer and programmer of Qbert. One of the greats from the golden age of arcade games, a game which recently celebrated its 40th anniversary last year. Warren, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. Pleasure to be here.
It's so cool to have you here. Qbert, yo, Qbert would be on the Mount Rushmore of the golden age of arcades.
Difficult to carve, though.
Yeah, difficult to carve the snout. I don't know, what do you call it? Is it a snout that Qbert has?
Which face would he be? Would he be...
I don't know who he would...
Would he be Lincoln?
Who's the analog? Yeah, sure. Let's go with Lincoln.
Yeah. Man, so Qbert, you know, like we're
saying... Cube Lincoln.
Cube Lincoln. one of the absolute classics from that era of arcades, and it was the first game that you worked on, is that correct?
That is, well, it's not the first game I worked on. It's the first game I had responsibility for.
Okay, interesting. Okay.
So, what was the first game you worked on? What was the path like to Qbert?
So I was hired by Gottlieb in January of 1982. And the first thing they had me do was work with a programmer named Tom Malinowski to sort of just learn the ropes, to learn the hardware, help him out with a game he was creating. That game was never released back in the day, although in recent years it was resurrected and put into a cabinet at the Galloping Ghost Arcade in outside of Chicago, and it's called Argus. Originally it went by many names.
Where did the whole idea for Qbert come from?
Well, so, you know, after that game was canceled, I mean, I didn't do much on it. I just was sort of helping out. But when it was canceled, then basically my job was to make a game. So I had to make a game. So I didn't have any, it was my first time. So I didn't really have like a million ideas sitting in my back pocket. But I really felt like I still had more to learn. I hadn't played with a couple of concepts like randomness or gravity in what I did for Argus. Ooh. So I really just wanted to teach myself some more things. And one day I just happened to see on a screen the cube pattern that was created by Jeff Lee, but he created it as a full screen image for Kan Yabamoto, who is another programmer, best known for Mad Planets. But that, of course, had yet to come. But he was playing around with switching the foreground and background planes, because our hardware had a foreground and a background, and he was just using that the cube pattern as eye candy, as a background, and then switching it for foreground, whatever. But I saw that on the screen, and I thought, oh, this is interesting, because if something were to fall and on the top, on if you carved it into a pyramid, and something fell on the top cube, it would have one of two ways to bounce, down to the left or down to the right. And so it seemed like, you know, I could do that, if I could program a ball bouncing down a pyramid of cubes, then I will have taught myself randomness, gravity, a little bit of collision detection. You know, it just seemed like a great goal, you know, as a programming exercise. And so that is what I set about to do, and that is what I did. I still was not thinking that this is a game. I just was trying to teach myself. So when people saw it, they thought, oh, this is pretty cool. You should do something with that. And I thought, oh, I guess I could have a player character who's hopping around the cube, you know, or the pyramid. So it just proceeded like that. I mean, I call it an evolutionary game design, because there literally was no game design at the beginning. It's just that every time I added something and I was done with it, then I said to myself, well, what should I do next?
When you describe it as a game about gravity, it's basically, you know, physics are a huge part of game development now, and it's kind of a prototype for all the physics we have now. And it's kind of funny, because that, like, kind of logically, you know, extends to slinkies, right? And those go downstairs too, and mm-hmm. things that, as you mentioned, rolling and falling. One interesting thing about the Qbert hardware and the cabinet itself is that if objects fall off that plane, they have a little bit of a timing, and then there's a physical knock from the cabinet, which I presume is like a pinball knocker. Is that what that is?
Yeah, that's exactly what that is. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And of course, Gottlieb had access to that hardware, because they were in the business of making pinball machines for many decades. So, did you have some involvement in that final packaging of Qbert? I mean, it's a diagonal joystick too. That's interesting too. And those are all like weird hardware things that seemed really fun to play with at the time. You know, how did you come about those, and what was your involvement there?
Well, I mean, the diagonal joystick, you know, I never ever looked at as revolutionary. I mean, given the play field, you had four ways to move, and they were all diagonal. So to take a four-way joystick and just rotate it 45 degrees, you know, I didn't see that as revolutionary. I just saw that as obvious. Why it threw so many people, even, you know, in the office, people in the office when I was developing it, it you know, they had a hard time with it. They just couldn't wrap their brain around that concept. But I, you know, I stuck to my guns, because there was no other option. Mm-hmm. So I didn't see that as particularly revolutionary. I mean, the 3D stuff, I mean, I was, you know, certainly fascinated with the trying to recreate a pseudo 3D environment with 2D hardware. That was, you know, the goal was always to try to move towards, you know, realism and photo quality. Even back then, we only had 16 colors, but we were, I think, all of us envisioning a time where, you know, we would have, you know, full physics and full, you know, graphics. Right. But at the time, you know, you work with what you have. And so that's kind of what I did.
What about the knocker? How'd that come about?
Yeah, the knocker was actually the idea of an engineering technician who worked for us. His name is Rick Tye. And he suggested it because, you know, as the game was developing, people in the office would watch it. So certainly had gotten to the point where, you know, Qbert's jumping off the pyramid, or Coily's falling off the pyramid. He thought, oh, what if we put a pinball knocker in there? And I thought, oh, that's an interesting idea. Let's try it, which we did. And, but the sound kind of bugged me, because it didn't sound like a body hitting the ground, which is what I wanted it to represent.
An adorable body this big.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, but it sounded like a knock at the door. And I thought, so we actually experimented with a lot of things we could put, in that spot where the knocker hits the cabinet to try to soften that sound. And I thought we came up with a pretty good solution. And I was very happy and excited. So we went to management and we said, hey, we got this great feature. Well, they were like, yeah, sure. We got millions of pinball knockers we could put in there. They probably wanted to get rid of them. But the foam, the little piece of foam that we put in to soften the sound, they were like, oh, well, we'd have to buy it. And we have to the labor for somebody to go in and glue it to the exact right spot. And they didn't want to go for that. So No, you know, as
do
wonderful
you recommend
as it is,
a mod, if you were going to recommend today to a Qbert mm-hmm. owner, you'd say you should get the phone because that's how it's supposed
I do.
To be.
I do that all the time now when I talk.
That's great.
I recommend that. Yeah, I've done it to my own cabinet at home. It sounds great.
Yeah, I mean, pinball knockers can be very violent. I mean, they're meant for a completely different purpose of reminding you not to walk away from your game, right?
I think luckily a lot of the machines that are still existing today, you know, those coils are 40 years old, and so they've softened a little bit. They're not quite as violent as new ones.
Don't I know it? We hear a lot about company culture at Atari and what that was like in especially, you know, 77 to 83 or so. What was Gottlieb's company culture like? What was the creative, you know, was it creative? Was it, you know, partying? Like what was it like to work there?
It changed over the course of the time I worked there. And I mean, I was there maybe two years. I don't think it lasted longer than that, but it changed quite a bit. When I started, we were, sort of a satellite group separate from the main plant, separate from the pinball factory. And we had a lot of freedom. And the two guys who ran the department, Howie Rubin was the VP of business development and Ron Waxman was the VP of engineering. And they were the guys who ran the department, and they protected us from Gottlieb's upper management back at the home plant.
Oh.
So, but they both were very much committed to letting the programmers do what they wanted. You know, they didn't impose anything. Basically, all they imposed was make a game. That's what they said. You're hired to make a game. Make us a game. And so it was very much of a like think tank environment when I started. There weren't a lot of people. Gottlieb had not released an in-house game when I started.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Tim Skelly was putting the finishing touches on Reactor when I was hired. So the
game.
Plant was empty, and it was a wonderful environment to sort of just work. There's no pressure. It seemed like there was, you know, it was just really an exploratory environment where the management put their trust in you. That changed after a while, but
yeah, I mean, I wanted to ask about that. It's kind of obvious why Gottlieb would get into video games at the time, because they were just huge and they had been making pinball machines for they're set up for this, right? But why did Gottlieb get out of it? Why was Qbert basically the flash in the pan, and then Gottlieb is not the household name in games now?
Well, first of all, it's not entirely true that Qbert was the only thing that Gottlieb produced. Qbert was certainly a huge success.
Popular one.
Mm-hmm. Mad Planets came out after. It wasn't the huge success it was, but it was a success. Mm-hmm. But the other blockbuster success they had was Mach 3, which was a Laserdisc game. And that was a huge, huge success for Gottlieb. Paved the way for my ability to do another Laserdisc game called Us Versus Them. But what happened, unfortunately, I mean, it was a mix of things. First of all, Gottlieb was owned by Columbia Pictures, which got bought by Coca-Cola.
Wow.
So now you had Coca-Cola was our corporate overlord. And it's questionable to me whether Coca-Cola really wanted to have a pinball company, a video game company. It's very possible they were influential maybe in shutting Gottlieb down, because that's what happened to Gottlieb. It was shut down. Okay. And I don't believe it was losing money either. It was shut down, but there were other factors like the crash. There was basically an arcade crash.
Exactly. Right.
Of course, you know, when video first had its, you know, its success, pinball waned. So I think they were a little leery of maintaining a pinball division because they thought pinball might be dying forever. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, video, there was an arcade crash in 84. Maybe they thought that's it. This is a flash in the pan. Just the video arcade industry is a flash in the pan, and that might be why they did it. But I wasn't there. You know, I was just a lowly grunt. So, Gottlieb was shut down by their parent company.
Well, that explains the Mellow Yellow connection then.
Yes, indeed. Yeah.
Well, getting back to the design of Qbert, you're experimenting with the pyramid design and the falling and bouncing mechanics. What about the actual character of Qbert? Where did that come from?
Right. Well, I had none. I had no characters in my back pocket, and I wasn't an artist. So the first thing I did when it was time to put a player character up is I went to basically the only artist available to us, who was Jeff Lee, who fortunately was an amazing artist and a genius. And I just said, Jeff, do you have any characters that you've created on your own that you're not using that I can borrow? And he put a bunch up on the screen. And I looked him over, and I liked the orange one with the long nose because he kind of looked somewhat pathetic. And I thought, oh, that's something people can relate to. So he granted me the use of that character, and he made me all the angles, you know, that I needed, and looking in the directions, and he just gave me everything I needed. And I went ahead and programmed that character. Now, I'll also mention that the reason he had the long nose, Jeff designed him that way because in Jeff's mind, he would be used in a game where he would shoot out of his nose.
Right. Oh,
that was, you know, and Jeff thought that was amusing. And so did I. I thought it was hysterical, actually. But it was way too complicated for me at the time. I'm trying to keep things simple. It's my first game. And the perspective, you know, the pseudo 3D perspective, I was like, oh, I have no idea how to make shooting work. So I really never seriously considered shooting out of his nose. I just used the character.
Mm-hmm. So Hubert was just like, it was more than a game at the time. It was a phenomenon. I think like Pac-Man and what we call mascots for video game companies later, like Mario and Sonic, you know, that's the kind of the company that Hubert, I think, keeps. There was a cartoon, there's lots of merchandise and other things. Do you recall like just like a bizarre place that Hubert turned up at the time that was just a shock to you?
Well, he turned up in the movie Moscow on the Hudson. That was pretty much of a shock.
Really?
I did not realize that he was going to be in that movie. I mean, that was a Robin Williams movie, came out somewhere, you know, 83, 84. I'm not really sure. But yeah, I remember seeing that movie, and there was a shot where Hubert was in it, and they actually had a close-up shot of Hubert jumping off the pyramid. I think I had heard stories. They filtered into me through, you know, channels that Robin Williams loved the sounds of Hubert and would, like, you know, make Hubert sounds, but never confirmed that. Never was able to confirm that.
That makes sense, right? The Hubert cartoon is wild, by the way. It's like an American Graffiti or like a kind of 50s amalgamation. Yeah.
Like soda shop. Yeah. Sort of vibe, right? Like,
yeah, right. And yeah, we were all we had no input, obviously.
Licensing, right?
Jeff and I, and of course, I need to mention the third member of our team, who's Dave Thiel, who did the sound. So, you know, we were what I call the Hubert triumvirate. You know, my job was designer and programmer, and I saw myself as a filter through which all ideas would pass, and I would say yes or no. But Dave and Jeff, their contributions were just so extraordinary and impactful that I always felt we were a team. Mm-hmm. And I loved working with them both. So, but I got sidetracked there. So, you know, the original, I can't remember the original question was,
we were just talking about weird places that Hubert showed up. And then we talked about the cartoon a little bit because the cartoon was so wacky.
Yeah, that's what we were on the cartoon. And I remember the three of us just saying, you know, what the hell? You know, I remember Jeff was stunned. I mean, people would say to us, what were you smoking when you came up with the idea for Hubert, right? But, you know, we looked at that cartoon show. We were like, what are these guys smoking when they took this video game and turned it into that, you know? I mean, he had arms. He spoke English. It's just like, okay. Yeah. I mean, I can sympathize with, you know, they're tasked with making a cartoon out of this video game that literally has no story attached to it. But yeah, I think we would have gone in a different direction.
So after Gottlieb, you went to Williams. Is that right?
Right. Yeah, okay. with a little brief interlude. When Gottlieb shut down, I took a job outside the video game industry, and I honestly didn't know if that was the end of my video game career because, you know, who knew? Yeah. But I got a call from a headhunter about a year and a half after that saying, would you like to get back in the video game industry? And I did not have to hesitate. So, and it was Williams calling. So, yeah, I went to work for Williams. It was around March of 1986, I think, something like that.
So we have to kind of wrap this interview shortly, but you presided over a pretty interesting series of huge hits at Midway at that point with the digitization of imagery into games that became Mortal Kombat and NBA Jam and stuff like that. That era was a return to form for arcades. Things really came back then. I mean, what was it like having kind of that resurgence that you were kind of alluding to?
Oh, it was fantastic. I mean, I think everybody I don't think anybody really thought arcades, people working on arcades games, I don't think thought that the video industry was going to die forever. I think it sort of was understood that it grew so fast and became saturated so fast, it made sense there was going to have to be a correction. It couldn't sustain that growth. So I don't know if the crash was that big of a surprise to people in the industry, but the fact that it came back, they hired me. So clearly it was coming back. I didn't have to predict anything. But I think what we always wanted to do in the arcade industry is stay one step ahead of the home games. Because we always felt, if people can get the same experience at home, why would they go to an arcade, right? I mean, obviously there are social reasons, but still, we wanted to stay one step ahead. And for me, that meant increasing the number of colors and trying to get more movie quality graphics or photo quality. And I really never envisioned the whole 3D polygon thing. When the industry went in that direction, I thought, oh, okay, I didn't see that coming. I always thought, it was the digitizing that was going to really, expand.
Sprites but of course, would just get better and better and better, right?
Right, right. But
and
then,
resolution.
Honestly, I think the 3D polygons were, in fact, the way to go because now, graphics are just insanely movie-like. Yeah. But yeah, I don't know that I would have even envisioned the quality of things like fur and hair and water and all the particle work. That just incredible. But it was fun to see it all sort of slowly come about.
All those advances must make it difficult to, I know Qbert's depicted in things like Wreck-It Ralph and stuff like that now, but it's just kind of funny to think of a character like that, like choosing, like, do we have to put fur on Qbert now? Like, what does he have, pimples? Like, what kind of creature is this?
Yeah.
The more detailed, the worse.
Even in the cabinet art, he has what looks like fur, so, I think that's not a decision that had to be made later on, but it was just being true to the character. But riding the Williams high, of all those hits was just fantastic, and of course my contribution was just making that digitizing system. It's really all the guys who used it, in different ways. Mortal Kombat, Ed Boon and John Tobias, the way they made their characters so large and divided them into body parts so that, it was genius. It was really a smart thing to do. And it just made the game stand out. I was also on the development team for Terminator 2 and Revolution X.
Yeah.
So I was working on those
games.
Yeah. While I wasn't the lead on those, that was George Petro and Jack Hager. So, but, I was contributing to those games. But all the other games like NBA Jam, I mean, really, my contribution was just the digitizing system, which I continued to improve over the years as our hardware got faster, our color resolution got better, our pixel resolution got better. So I would put in more advanced features, blah, blah, blah. But it was fun for me because to me, that was the future.
Yeah,
you'd come a long way since Journey and the little black and white photos of Japan.
Yeah, right, exactly, exactly.
Well, Warren, thank you so much for joining us today. You've had such a very cool career from Qbert to, the tech that made Mortal Kombat possible. It's very, very cool. Like I said, I think Qbert absolutely holds up today as one of the all-time great arcade games that is still. If I walked into an arcade today and they had Qbert, I'd want to play Qbert.
Well, thank just you. As fun I as it ever was. That means a lot to me. And I should mention if anybody wants to hear more about that in more details, I have written a memoir which just came out this year.
Oh, very cool.
And it's available on Amazon, and I welcome anybody to check it out. It's called Creating Qbert and Other Classic Video Arcade Games.
Very
that
cool.
Is extremely cool.
I think I will check that out myself. All right, Warren, thank you so much. Congratulations again.
Thank you so much,
congrats,
guys.
Yeah. 40.
Okay, this is the next email from our archives. This is also from November 2019. And now we're starting to get into stuff where the listeners are commenting on what we were talking about at the time. Let's see if we can remember. This is Guy. Guy says, I'm a long-term listener here, fan of the show. I'm from Belgium. I'm in my late 30s. I started playing games on the Atari 2600. Smurfs was the OG Dark Souls on that thing. Just thinking about that era turns on the bleeps and bloop noises in my head. I own just about every console since then. Actually owned a game store for over 8 years, specializing in retro games. After that, I started working for Microsoft as a product marketing manager for 5 years. So yeah, I have some history. This makes me a very active participant whenever you guys are playing 20 Questions. I got triggered by last week's episode to finally write in when you mentioned the pause music for Asterix. First of all, this is Damon talking. We all know who we're talking about here.
I mean, Asterix.
The comic, yeah. Like the comic book
it's character. It's the Viking that there's an NES game for that only came out in Europe.
Okay, it's funny you just said that. Getting back to Guy's email. Asterix is not a Viking. He's a Gaul. Gauls were from northern France and Belgium before those
countries. You read this email on the show before. I remember Guy writing in and correcting
us. Not this one.
Really?
Not this one.
I thought we got corrected on the Gallic nature of...
Yeah, he goes on a lot in the history of Europe and Asterix. He says, Asterix is a comic book from where I am and is as famous here as Spider-Man to you guys. Mm-hmm. Many movies and games have been released over the past 30 years or so. It's a continuing successful franchise. So I don't know why we were talking about Asterix, which is a character that I'm only familiar with through this video game that we're seeing here, which I've never played. I've just like seen the box and like seeing the artwork. That's all.
I mean, my normal answer would be that Jared was on the show. Maybe that was the case.
It could be Asterix and Obelix.
Yeah.
I don't know why we would have been talking about it. You must be right. It must be Jared Petty. This is another email from Milko, who says, I'm listening to episode 555 and heard you guys have a small debate about who Asterix is. I'm not one for corrections, but this is close to my heart since I grew up with Asterix. Asterix is from Gaul, a territory in what is now France. Not Greek or a Viking. He's one of two main characters in the Asterix and Obelix series of comics, which also spawned many animated movies and games, as well as a live-action film or two. The foundation of the stories is blah, 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 blah. Over 30 comic books are in existence, and the animated movies are each based on a book, blah, 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 blah. Anyways, hope you find this interesting and that you check Asterix out. I'm sure you'll have some fun.
Okay, and so also, if you check Asterix out, you'll be forgiven for thinking that they have some sort of Viking nature to them because they all have little Viking helmets and are wearing braids and beat people up with axes.
Yep. Yeah.
But as was the style at the time.
Which was the style at the time. Asterix, not a very popular character here in the United States, I don't think.
Yeah, so we didn't get the NES port.
Okay, this is Leo Mateo, also from November 2019, commenting on I have no idea what we would have been talking about. He says, Omega Cops, I'm a long-time listener. I love GameScoop to the death. Best podcast IGN has going by far. I was listening to GameScoop this week. I have a few things to say. Number one, I was also an owner of a ColecoVision. It was my first console. I'm 37. I own two games, Donkey Kong and a top five worst game of all time, Smurfs.
Yeah,
literally, the grass killed you. The grass killed you in Smurfs, apparently.
Everything kills you in Smurfs, and then you get to the end of the level or the end of the first part, and you have no idea how to progress. It's fascinating.
Number two, he says, I'm a veteran, so I know that the military does not use bazookas anymore. They use an evolved form of it called the AT-4 anti-tank, and yes, the trigger is on the top. We were talking about bazookas, I guess. I often wonder things like, do they still use bazookas?
Yeah,
that's still a thing.
Well, whenever you get them in Resident Evil, they call them RPGs, right? The rocket propelled grenades, which is still a tube with a rocket in it. It's just bazooka must have been the old school terminology for a different version of it.
But in like Resident Evil, like your RPGs, you're holding it like kind of like a shotgun. So
no, you hold it up, right? Well, what about Metal Gear?
Hold
it up, right?
In Metal Gear,
you hold it up, yeah. And then Call of Duty is the AT-4 as well. So
I think when you get the Infinite Launcher, I think you hold it up. I think Leon holds it up like this, especially for the one. Yeah, I think so.
You may be right.
There's no way to know. Maybe
I have seen. Yeah. Anyway. Okay, this is an email from Kevin. I don't think we're gonna have much. I don't think we're going to be able to help Kevin because Kevin writes, this is his message with no punctuation or capitalization. Mm-hmm. This is Kevin from Pennsylvania. I wanted to ask you guys, my NAT type is strict on Xbox. Unsuccessful, guys, should I worry about? Because when I go online, I get no lag whatsoever. Let me know. First time writing in. Keep up the great work. Watch you guys every week. Sam's my favorite.
I would have liked at the end of that, and beware of 2020, y'all.
I mean, pro tip, NAT type 2. There you go. You're good to go, man. So yeah, that adjust that on your modem, and you're good to go.
Yeah. Okay. $5.
This is Tobias in Stockholm, Sweden. Does this location give you any sort of guess as to what he's writing in about?
About Asterix?
I just listened to GameScoop episode 555. I noticed that you guys didn't seem to know Asterix and Obelix. First of all, they are not Vikings. Neither are they Romans. They are Gaulish warriors fighting the Roman Empire. But is this French comic series not known in America? No, Tobias. No. No one knows who these people are. And if they are aware
not
of them,
people,
they think,
they're Gauls.
If they are aware of them, they think they're Vikings. We got just a couple more here. This is Cena from Royal Oak, Michigan. I think we're getting into actually some serious questions now. I was browsing through IGN's list of the 100 greatest games of all time. Notice that the top two games on the list, Legend of Zelda, Link to the Past, and Super Mario World, were both released almost 30 years ago. Maybe they were 30 years ago by at this point. I'm not here to argue their right to be at the top of this list, but with how much games have evolved since the Super Nintendo, I'm surprised that no game has been able to unseat these two 16-bit titles. Do you think that the next three decades will bring along a game that can top this list? If so, what would it take to claim the title of greatest game of all time, or will nothing ever be able to compete with these 2D classics?
And what happened since then? We redid that list. And what's number one? A game that had come out by that time, even.
Wait,
Breath of the Wild.
Oh, no, it's Breath of the Wild.
What is our current number one? I don't want to. Oh, it's Wild. Breath of the Wild?
Yeah. I think God of War is up there, too.
It is interesting. You know, I bet when there's a whole new regime in games media, it will be interesting to see, like, what the top 100 games of all time look like 20, 30 years from now.
Yeah,
I mean, it's also a tricky conversation, too, based on like the demographics of the people who are putting the list together. Right. Because, you know, like I was saying earlier, like NES and SNES were my first consoles. Therefore, I have some sort of nostalgia for, you know, Chrono Trigger is one of my favorite games of all time. But to a good friend of mine who's never like played Chrono Trigger, they're like, They were able to revisit it in 2020 and they had a fantastic time doing so. So maybe there is something to just games that are fundamentally good to play no matter what age you are. And I think Link to the Past, I think Super Mario World are there for a reason because they are pretty pick up and play no matter what you do.
All right, I'll read you our top 10 games. And you can see there's even a little bit of recency bias in here.
Yeah, I think I know what you mean with number 10.
Yeah, 10, Disco Elysium. I'm sure that game holds up and people love it. I'm not slagging that game, but the 10th best game of all time was a strong argument from our staff that year, and I don't know if they'd make that argument. Half-Life 2 is number 9. Number 8 is Red Dead Redemption 2. Number 7 is Super Mario 64. Number 6 is Mass Effect 2. Number 5 is Super Metroid. That's getting a little rusty, I think. Number 4 is The Legend of Zelda, A Link to the Past. Number 3 is Portal 2. Number 2 is Super Mario World, and number 1 is The Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild. So, still a lot of classics in there, but, you know, I think we worked hard on number 13 is Hades, so you can tell, like, you know, there was some modern influence in there, and not only modern influence, but games that had kind of come out that year. These are things that happen when you vote on things.
Yeah. But like I was saying, like, kids that are like 10 years old today, you know, when they grow up and they, when you have a whole like generation of people that didn't grow up with a Super Nintendo or an NES, they didn't grow up with even an N64, like a PlayStation 2 or GameCube was their first console, you know, those lists are going to look totally different 20, 30 years from now.
Yeah.
Probably a lot of Minecraft in the top tens, I would assume. Yeah,
that's another
Minecraft, Overwatch, League of Legends, Dota. That's going to be it. That's going to be the tops.
Maybe Fortnite? Like, I kind of feel like it's such a prescient thing.
I mean,
Super Mario Brothers 1 was at the top of our list when I started, so definitely Fortnite.
Like, in the times we grew up, with gaming media, which was magazines in like the 90s and stuff, gaming was so much smaller then that to be like, to consider yourself a gamer and like to read those magazines, you basically had an interest in at least knowing about every video game that was out there, even if you weren't playing them. I think there was a general consensus as to like what the best games were for each platform. But gaming is so big, so broad now. There's so many different like niches and genres that have come around since then. Like there are people that are hardcore into just like one very specific game or genre, but they don't play anything else. So I feel like there's much less of a consensus today as to like what the greatest games are of all time.
I bet the people that spend that much time with, you know, live games or service games that play them, they don't even think of those as the best games ever. They're just, that's just their social life, right?
Yeah.
So it's like, it complicates things immensely.
One more question from 2019. This came from Jonathan, who asks, if sport games were no more, would you care? When was the last time you played a sports game? Do you think sports games have had an effect or has influenced video games or the game industry in any way, whether it be significant or not?
Let's just have Nick handle this one.
Okay.
I mean, I think this is such an interesting question because I think for the most part, a lot of the staff at IGN, there are a couple outliers. I know Ryan McCaffrey, I know Cat Bailey, they like sports titles.
But I think the UK plays the soccer games.
I think a vast majority, though, could bat an eyelid at these games going away forever. But I think that is kind of a disservice to some extent because I think by exposing yourself to what 90% of the rest of the world loves to play, a la FIFA, I think you can learn a lot more about gaming and gaming practices as a whole, especially in regards to like the FIFA all whatever they call their card thing. Like, it's such an interesting thing that if God of War had a collectible card game that came with it that you could buy and invest in, people would lose their minds. But the fact that it's happening for FIFA and it's so just expected as part of the population is so fascinating to me. But if it were the enthusiast side of the press, I think there'd be pitchforks all over the place. Also, I love the idea that you're seeing a lot more sports games now with their single player modes, having a lot more of a light RPG experience integrated in. I think that's good. So, you see like normal AAA style experiences started to leak into sports games. And I think you're also seeing the inverse of that as well, where you have aspects and mechanics from sports games leak into contemporary AAA games. Like Persona 5 has a home run contest in it, you know, stuff like that. Like, I don't know. I like that they exist because they could inspire and influence and also just a different side of the gaming culture.
Mm-hmm. Time was that those were the couch competitive games, right? And then like mm-hmm. NHL 94 era, right? And then we got couch competitive cart games and shooters. So, like that was kind of next generation of that. But from what I understand, people still get together and play, you know, NBA 2K on the couch, right? Like that's still a part of it. And I think hockey is still really fun. NHL games are still pretty fun that way. So that's a really cool aspect of those games.
And I was watching that, what is it, Welcome to Wrexham show that Rob McElhenney put together. And like players that are on the soccer team, they live together and when they're done playing soccer IRL, they play FIFA together in the same room. So it's just like, it is so pervasive in a way that I don't think even stuff like God of War is, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Football's life.
Yeah. And I think sports games have probably been really influential to other games in the industry in terms of the march towards realism, right? Mm-hmm. Realistic graphics. Because like sports games were the first games that I would like glance at a TV totally. And think I was seeing a real sporting event, right?
Yeah. Well, and they were the early, really early breakthrough voices. That was like a big deal. Mm-hmm. I mean,
yeah.
Freaking Madden, right, was the voice in the game. And before that, it was like Joe Montana talking football. Like all those games were innovative.
And I forget which MLB game it was, but that was like an active effort put forth by the developer and probably one of the execs that this game needs to look as indistinguishable from real life as possible. And so when it came out now, it's primitive by our standards. But like when it
what
came
about
out, it's
the
like,
elements
whoa.
Of to your point, Nick, the elements of games leaking into reality, because now there's like all of the you know, lines and scoring and augmented reality stuff that they add that were like totally in video games before that. It's so cool.
The UI influence, man. It's great.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay, that brings us to Video Game 20 questions.
And we're going to play one? It's so unfair. Yeah,
it is. Well.
Let's do it.
I'm going to help you.
Make sure it's really hard.
It is from 2019. Now, and it comes from, who is this from? Luke, in an undisclosed location.
We lost the 20 questions that you will never hear, too. So.
Oh, yeah. Should we let the audience know what the game was, or just?
I can't remember what it was. Give me a hint.
There was a meta. It had to do with the release of God of War.
Had to do with the release of God of War. I can't believe I can't remember. This was 2 days ago. was it a game that I'd never heard of, though? Was that what it was?
No, you know the game.
Oh, yeah. That was the Tom Clancy was the week before.
Let's see. I'll give you hints. Nick, it's a God of War wannabe from the 360
This is a licensed game. That's not really licensed.
Yeah. Oh, Dante's Inferno.
Yeah, it was Dante's Inferno.
Yeah, we should have had Nick on.
Okay, this week's suggestion comes from Luke in an undisclosed location. Let the questioning begin.
Is this based on a license?
No.
Is this on a Nintendo platform? Bad question.
That's a good question.
No, it's not.
Oh, okay.
Is this a platform exclusive?
It was a, it was a console exclusive.
Was it a PlayStation console exclusive?
Yes.
Before the year 2000 or after the year 2000?
It has to be yes or no.
Oh, yeah, sorry. Is this after the year 2000?
No. That's five.
Oh, weird.
So basically early PlayStation life then.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Hashtag early PlayStation life. maybe it's Final Fantasy VII. That came to PC after being kind of an exclusive.
It is on everything. Is this an RPG?
No.
Makes
me think it's something weird like Medieval. I don't know.
Yeah, totally. Because now that's on Switch or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. Was this published by Sony?
Hold please. No.
Oh man.
Interesting. Okay. That's pretty cool.
Is this a 2D game?
No.
Do you play? Well, but
hold on. Okay. 2D game. Okay, this just gets us, it always gets us into trouble. Please rephrase your question to
mean
like.
Does this game use polygons?
Yes, it does. And then what was your next question? You play as a human?
Yeah.
Yes.
Could it be a fighting game?
I mean, the way he was, again, I always do this.
You know what I mean? Because that's like a 3D game, but on a 2D plane.
Yeah. What
does this game have multiplayer?
No, and that's 10. Yeah.
Makes me think it could be something like Symphony of the Night, because that game is technically 2D but uses a lot of polygons.
Yeah, I would call that straight 2D, but who knows? It's just going on in Damon's brain.
Not an RPG.
And it's that's pretty obviously not published by Sony, right? You wouldn't have to look that up.
Yeah, correct.
Is this part of a series?
Yes.
Is it the first of its name?
Yes.
Is this a platformer?
No.
Does this have military aspects?
Military. I'm skimming. Some information here. I'm looking for any sign. Maybe I can't answer that one. I can't answer that one.
Well, let's do this. Is this set in the present day?
Yes. Well, of its time. It was set in the present day.
What are we at right now?
That's 14 questions.
We just don't know anything about what the game looks like or is. Makes it hard. Not a platformer, you know. Not an RPG.
RPG. Leaves what, action shooter?
Could it be a sports game?
Is it a sports game?
No, that's 15.
It's not a platformer.
Do we know if it's a Japanese game? Does that matter at this point? We need like a Hail Mary where it's like, you know, something really specific about it.
Is it a Japanese game?
Yes.
I wonder if it's like a really weird one, like Vib Ribbon. Is that what that game's called?
Yeah, that is. But that's a Sony published one.
Oh, right? Was this game on the PlayStation Mini?
No.
Man. It sounds like a little obscure. I don't think I would get this one. I wasn't really a PlayStation fan at the time.
Is this a bullet hell game?
No.
Do we have one question and a guess?
Yes.
All right.
Oh, man. What's the... What can we do?
We hit all the genres, you know? That's kind of crazy. We did a lot of them, but we did fighting game, RPG.
Here's your hint. I said it was a console exclusive. And Sam mentioned games that also came to PC, but I never said anything about PC.
Yeah. So it's maybe an arcade game. Was this an arcade game?
Yes.
Okay.
And that brings us to your guess.
All right.
Oh, man. Arcade game, PlayStation.
So we got the Sega ones. It's not going to be those. That's Crazy Taxi and stuff like that, right?
Right. Was there like a bloody roll? You ever ask a fighting game thing?
Yeah, I did. Right, I asked about fighting games. Right, so that eliminates like there are the Virtua games. Sega also, so it's not going to be Virtua Racing.
That is Sega. Yeah.
Daytona Race. I'm thinking of racing now. Wipeout, is that one?
I don't think there was ever an arcade though of Wipeout.
Yeah, I don't think so either. Yeah, I don't think we're going to get this. And we asked if it was based on a license, right? So it's not going to be like Phantom Menace racing, pod racing.
And it was the first of its name.
House of the Dead, maybe?
Do you want to just do that one?
No, but that's Sega also, right?
Yeah, that is Sega.
It's got to be not. We got to pick one to guess that's not a Sega game. That's what makes it really hard, though.
I think...
Lethal Enforcer.
I think. What about something like Silent Scope? Because wasn't Silent Scope released on PlayStation? I don't know.
I have no idea. I wish we knew if it was a light gun game. Maybe. How about DDR?
I think that's a safe bet.
Okay, is this Dance Dance Revolution?
It is not. And you guys got very, very close there right before that. It is an on-rails light gun shooter called Time Crisis.
Oh
shoot.
All right. Because I think DDR was PlayStation 2, but it was a noble effort.
I kept thinking of Virtua Cop.
I know, me too. I forgot about Virtua Cop. That was the one that tipped my tongue, but I kept on dismissing that because that was too early, I thought.
There it is.
Wow.
Yeah, Time Crisis from Namco.
Funny.
Hit arcades in 95, then came to PS1 in 97.
Man, Ridge Racer's Namco also, right? So that could have worked.
Mm-hmm.
Crap. Okay. Remember that next time, Nick. Namco made arcade games all through the 90s.
There we go.
Funny. That was a good one. That was a good one. I like that. I would have never gotten it, but it's good.
No, you're aware of this game, though, right?
Not really.
Oh, yeah, of course. I would have killed for a Time Crisis, like, with the light gun in my home setup. I would have killed for it.
This is the first time I've ever seen what Time Crisis looks like, but I'm aware of the title of it. I know it's an arcade game.
They're so fun.
It's weird that it was a single-player game.
Yeah.
We're used to seeing these as two players.
Plugging away at this, right?
Yeah.
They did that in Time Crisis, too. Basically, this was just the primitive one, and nobody actually... I feel like... everyone likes Time Crisis 2, and I feel like nobody really talks about the first one.
Look how the frame rate, it looks great.
Yeah, the game looks gorgeous.
It's like polygons with sprites all mixed in.
I think we are on the cusp of like super nostalgia for this style PlayStation game that we're going to see.
And Nintendo 64.
Like, mm-hmm.
Although there were three of them on PS1.
Oh, wow, look how it has like a cell shading.
Yeah, that's like a Mega Man Legends look. That's awesome.
Crazy. That's crazy. Cool.
There was Time Crisis and Time Crisis 2, and then there was Time Crisis Project Titan.
Of course.
They're all on PS1.
Who could forget? Well, that was a perfect ending to a perfect scroop.
It's true. Nick, I don't think there are any bullet hell shooters on PS1.
No, there's like the top down like Thunder Force or whatever. That there's like one of those games. It came on a PS1 demo disc.
So you narrowed down our Game Scoop 20 questions to a one game possibility.
No, you didn't know the title of. There's a couple. I'm just saying, if there was like bullet hell, I was like, okay, it's got to be one of these Japanese like top down shooter jet things that you start on Earth and you go into space, and it's a bullet hell.
Saturn got a lot of those. That's for sure.
I played it religiously on my demo disc.
So there was
the name of it.
There's Einhander, but it's not bullet hell.
Hold on. I have it probably somewhere. No, not that
bullet hell is like bullet hell is just it's a very specific type.
I'm very aware. I'm pretty sure. I'm gonna message you. I can't probably find it right now at this moment, but I have some existence of it on my computer locally that I will message you later on.
I'm with Nick on this. I'm sure there's something, but you know, that was right on the cusp of bullet. Well, no, late 90s, it could have had stuff, but you know, Sega really took all those.
Oh yeah.
Well, nicely job. Thank you, Luke from 2019, for the suggestion. Viewers, if you have your own suggestions for video game 20 questions, email them to me at the email address, gamescoop@ign.com. That's all the scoops that we have for you this week. Thank you both, Sam and Nick, for helping me to get an episode out the door, if not the original episode this week. And thank you for all of your emails. I knew there's a reason why I keep all these emails just lying around in my inbox.
Yeah, just like any hoarder, you know there's a reason for it.
And now, so with those out of the way, now there are only 3,277 emails left.
Nice.
My game scoop.
Let's have more scoops, and then we can get through them.
I gotta play some Obelix.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, shout out to all the Gauls out there. My Gallic pals.
Okay. Thank you to Red for hopping on this and recording this episode for us on such short notice. My name is Damon. This is IGN Gamescoop, and we're out.
Bonsoir.
Hey there, this is Justin Bartha. I made a funny new podcast, King of the Egg Cream. It has the greatest cast in the history of podcasts with actors like Louis Black.
I'm torn by my feelings for two women.
Bobby Cannavale.
You can eat it, or if someone hits you, you can put it on your cut.
Melanie Lynskey.
I wonder what these marvelous things are that look just like boiled chicken feet.
Jason Ritter.
I can break things and pick locks and kill people.
Michael Stuhlbarg.
The whole point is to inspire people that they should make themselves better.
Ari Grainer.
No, don't whet its appetite. What are you, an idiot?
Me, Justin Bartha.
That's not just any egg cream, that's a Lemke special.
And all narrated by the hilarious Richard Kind.
This is the story of Harry Dalowitz. And how he rose from nothing to become New York's King of the Egg Cream.
So if you like funny true stories, come listen to King of the Egg Cream, available wherever you get your podcasts.